Our third case this morning is Acosta v. Foreclosure Connection 17-4111. Mr. Ross, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors and Chief Judge. David Ross, I represent Foreclosure Connection, Inc. and Jason Williams in this matter. I'm going to refer to Foreclosure Connection, Inc. as Foreclosure. I'm also going to refer to the appellee plaintiff, R. Alexander Acosta, Secretary of Labor for the U.S. Department of Labor, as the Secretary. Our argument, I believe, is quite simple when it relates to the issue of whether or not there was any retaliation in this particular case. There were two men working for Foreclosure, a Michael Scott Barber and a Michael Barber. Michael Barber is the father of Michael Scott Barber, so I'm going to refer to Michael Barber as Barber Sr. and the son as Barber Jr. They were fired from working for Foreclosure on July 8th of 2015. And the government is, and the court concluded that they were fired for retaliatory purposes under 29 U.S.C. 215. We're of the opinion, of course, that they weren't fired for that purpose. And our argument is simple, that for purposes of there to be retaliation, it would be necessary for the decision maker, and the court has presented ample findings that Jason Williams was the decision maker. He made decisions on a daily basis, who did what work, when and where, and he's the one who ordered his foreman, Jack Erickson, to terminate the barbers. Termination occurred on July 8th, 2015, and that's in the court's findings that that occurred on that date. That's also consistent with the barbers themselves. Barber Sr. had, and on that date, it stipulated fact that Jack Erickson told the barbers not to show up to work that morning, and they typically would show up about 7 a.m.
That seems a little ambiguous, that conversation to me. You wouldn't necessarily construe that as a separation of employment. Wasn't there evidence in the record that they would come to work as needed, and that if there wasn't work on a particular day, they need not to come to work? It seems to me like that the conversation on the morning of July 11th doesn't necessarily suggest that they were terminated the morning of July 8th.
I don't know about the way you addressed it, but the facts of the case and the findings of the court were that Jason Williams, the owner of Foreclosure, he would, on a daily basis, decide what workers worked what sites. And as far as I know, there is nothing in the record about their working this day or that day. They worked every day, the workers did, and on the various projects that Foreclosure had. It was just a matter of whether Jason made those assignments. So on July 8th, the barbers were told not to show up to work, and afterwards...
That's when they were fired is your position?
And the court's finding. And it's our position, and I believe...
Could you
also
just point what paragraph in that?
That is under paragraph 38, where the court is talking about the barbers working on July 7th at the Lamborn worksite, and the court refers to this as being the day before they were fired. And the court is making the determination they were fired, so he has this the adverse action in order that's necessary in a retaliation case.
Paragraph 35? Is that paragraph 35?
38, I believe.
Pardon me?
38, I believe. It's one.
He says it a couple times, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does a couple times, but the one time that I'm referring to is where the court is actually, it's innocuous as to whether or not this is the finding that the court made that termination, but the court is making that statement that they went to work on July 7th at the Lanbourne site, and that was the last day before they were fired.
Clarify the record for me. So there was that conversation in the morning of the 8th. Then the investigator from the state interviewed Mr. Williams or Mr. Erickson, and then isn't there also evidence that then in the afternoon of July 8th, Erickson was instructed to tell the barbers that they were terminated?
That I don't know is in evidence. It was the
What's your position on the sequence of events?
Well, the sequence of events is,
if I'm right in this opinion, what's the winning timeline for you?
Okay, the winning timeline is,
where is that in the record?
In addition to the court making the finding that they were fired on July 8th, Michael Barber Sr., or Barber Sr., also was of that same opinion. They were told not to show up for work, and you had indicated, well, they would work some days and not. They worked every day. And after July 8th, they were not invited back. In fact, and the investigator is actually one from the secretary's investigator, Sheffield Keith, appeared at the offices on July 8th. But after, and it's stipulated after, the call in the morning to not show up for work, he goes ahead, this is Michael Barber Sr., and tells the investigator on July 23rd that, quote, not fired, just not invited back to work, end of quote. In other words, and I agree with your thought process, you know, was he really terminated on that exact day? Because there was some sequence of events, and those sequence of non-events, I'm going to say.
So they're independent contractors, aren't they, barbers?
No. The court made a determination that they were employees,
even though
he was a general contractor, but he made a determination that they were employees. And they did work, there were just a few days that Michael Barber did not work, but that occurred even before his son went to work for foreclosure. But they worked every day, and except for holidays and weekends, foreclosure. None of the employees worked on those days, but they worked every day. And so on that day, they're told they're not invited back afterwards. So I kind of look at it as the effective date of termination would have been July 8th. When they're told not to show up to work and they're not invited back and they're not assigned work. And that's the thought process of Michael Barber Sr. That's the thought process of my client. And the court made that finding that that was the firing date. So I think that, I don't know of any other date where they were fired. There was the next sequence after the appearance of Sheffield Keith, the secretary's lead investigator in this matter. He appeared and announced that he was conducting an investigation, explained what he was going to be doing, asked for some documentation, and then that week had interviewed workers on site to ask them, interview them, find out things. And Jason Williams was aware of this. In fact, to give it more clarity, a week later, and this is a finding of the court, in our arguments, except for one thing, and I'll get into that in a minute, our arguments are based upon the findings of the court. We haven't included any of our own arguments and findings, but in this particular case, that these are the findings of the court. A week later, the court found that Jason Williams told Jack Erickson to never hire the barbers again, which gives us thought process, and from the English language, that that means they weren't working there anymore, so never hire them again can't mean that they were still working there. And he's just instructing him too. And then he goes into make the statement, because, and this is a finding by the court, because it is likely that the that they turn me into the wage and hour division. And that doesn't sound like somebody who knew about any of these the overtime claims and knew about the filings on July 7th by the barbers at the U.S. Department of Labor.
What's the central error by the district court then?
I'm sorry?
What is the central error by the district court?
Well, well, there's two things. We indicate that there was a it was ignored, the non-retaliatory reason that was expressed by Jack Erickson in the telephone conversation that's between he and the barbers. The barbers contacted him, and they recorded the conversation unbeknownst to Jack Erickson. Jack Erickson and Mr. Barber, even though this is after the termination, had been friends for over 20 years. That's in the evidence, and they had been roommates at one time. And this is a very candid conversation. In that conversation, the court is using that conversation to demonstrate that there was an adverse action. Maybe the judge was concerned about the fact that they're told not to show up to work. Doesn't sound like you're fired. And but the court, in order to show that they were fired, goes to look at this candid conversation between the barbers and Jack Erickson, where Jack Erickson is stating that they were fired. So now we have the adverse action. The court has the adverse action. However, in that same conversation, Jack Erickson, an agent of foreclosure and the foreman, is also stating the reason they were fired. He's stating it was because there was some tags that were issued. In fact, he's talking about his, he's telling the barbers, this is what I told Sheffield Keith, and Sheffield Keith wanted to know what happened, and I told Sheffield Keith, this is Jack Erickson, that there were some tags issued by, and they refer to, he refers to one city, but there were two cities, that stopped workage on the properties because they didn't have the proper permits. Jason Williams found out about it, and at that given point in time was pissed, as Jack Erickson states, and told me to let Mike go, and I let, and that was it for Mike, and Mike was fired. Basically was fired. And
attempt to synthesize what you just said about the errors? I have the issues here for us to decide. Is number one, does the FLSA anti-retaliatory provisions apply to your clients?
Yes.
And number two, did the district court make an error in finding that your barbers were discharged because of their complaints to the Department of Labor? That was the second issue, and do you assert that yes?
Yes.
That was the error.
It was an error. My clients were subject to, the court made a finding, and we did not challenge that finding, that it wasn't even necessary for there to be authority under the FLSA to make a finding of retaliation under 29 U.S.C. 215. And we did not challenge that, so I can't hear today say that was an error on the part of the court. So, in fact,
what is the error then?
What
are you asking us to correct and why? In two or three sentences.
Okay.
Give us a roadmap.
Okay. In this particular case, our theme is that in order to retaliate against someone, the decision maker has to have knowledge of the protected activity. And in this case, there is just no evidence, and there is actually evidence that he didn't have, but there's no evidence that the decision maker, again, a finding by the court that he's the decision maker, had any knowledge of the protected activity.
Who was the decision maker, Erickson or Williams?
No, it was Williams. The court made the finding that he was the one, the decision maker. He's the one who told Jack Erickson each and every day who to go, what sites he wanted to work on, who he wanted working there, and so forth. And he went into three different paragraphs of making that finding that he is the decision maker. And he's the one that, in the candid conversation that was recorded, it's Jack Erickson talking about Jason's telling me to fire him. So, he's the one who was the decision maker on the termination. And the point we want to make is that, and I know I'm running out of time, but there was one really critical point because there was no finding by the court as to whether or not Jason Williams knew about claims of overtime from that would also be a protected activity. I think it's clear, and real quick on the that he didn't know about their filing of the complaints. The logistics are that they filed the complaints in Salt Lake City. That's where the U.S. Department of Labor is, and their offices are in Taylorsville, Utah, which would be like a complaint filed here against somebody in Aurora, Colorado, and would they know about it happening that afternoon before 7 a.m. the next day? Not likely. And we also have the testimony where he is saying that after Sheffield Keith has appeared and there's all these investigation going on, that it is that he wants tells Jack, never hire these folks again because it's likely they turn me in. If he knew they had filed their complaints, he wouldn't say likely.
Okay. Got it. Your time's expired. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Let's hear from the Department of Labor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Sarah Marcus. I represent the Secretary of Labor. With me at counsel table is Courtney Witten, who represented the Secretary at the trial in this matter. Your Honors, foreclosure is asking you to reach a...
phone away from you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Foreclosure is asking you to adopt a conclusion that requires you to believe that the district court didn't understand the implications of its own factual findings and that is different from any version of events that foreclosure suggested were the truth.
Could you pull the microphone away from you, please?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, just push it. Just push it. There you go. Thanks.
Okay.
Let's try that.
All right. I apologize. So foreclosure is asking you to adopt a conclusion that requires you to believe the district court didn't understand the implications of its own factual findings and that is different from any version of events that foreclosure was advancing at any point before this appeal.
Well, if they were fired in the morning of July 8th, then there would be no causal connection to the complaint to the department.
So, Your Honor,
and isn't that their theory if you boil it all down?
That's their theory
okay,
now.
Okay, and what's the rebuttal to that?
That the district court couldn't have understood that to be the case, because the district court concluded that they were fired because they had complained to the Wage and Hour Division, which is based on plenty of evidence in the record. Erickson made a statement to that effect to the investigator on August 4th, which appears in the appendix. He testified at trial that that's why the barbers were fired. The barbers testified at trial that that's what Erickson made them believe, and another employee, Zeke Magana, also testified that that's what Erickson said. There's also the recorded conversation between Erickson and the barbers that the secretary
does
interprets
the, does the findings of fact and conclusion of law demonstrate that sequence?
It's not as finely parsed as it could be, Your Honor, and that's because foreclosure wasn't making this argument below. In their interrogatories, in Williams' deposition, and in the testimony at trial, at no point did they say that the barbers were fired on the morning of July 8th.
But don't we at the least have to remand for clarification? And there's twice. Here the court says in its decision, the balance of the evidence indicates that the barbers worked these hours as both Magana and Erickson testified, consistent with the barbers' own testimony, that they knew the barbers were working on July 7, 2015, the last day before the barbers were fired. And there's a similar, well, I had it underlined here. Where the court says that. And I just don't think we can ignore that and say, obviously the district court was confused. You make a decent argument that we should send it back down for the district court to clarify what it's deciding. But when the court explicitly says something like that, we can't ignore that, I don't think.
Your Honor, it's certainly this court's prerogative to remand. I think that, although, again, the court could, it's not really necessary and would expend additional resources where it's clear from the opinion as a whole and from the conclusions that the district court drew that that language is perhaps less precise than one would like, but is inconsistent with the reading where the court didn't understand whether the barbers were fired in retaliation for complaints of the Wage and Hour Division. The last day they worked was July 7th. They didn't go back after July 8th. They weren't invited back that morning, the evidence indicates, because there was a work stoppage because of an issue with city permits, and they were expected by everyone to come back once the work resumed. Okay. But in the intervening time, Jason Williams drew the conclusion that the barbers had complained to the Wage and Hour Division and decided he never wanted them to work for him again, and that was the retaliatory action.
You don't have an alternative argument that even if they were fired on July 8th, you win. You're not arguing that. I'm not sure what your argument would be, but I just want to make sure that you're not arguing you have an alternative ground.
Your Honor, as Judge Timkovich indicated, there is some evidence in the record that Jason Williams made the decision by later in the day on July 8th. And it's also the case that the decision not to hire them back because they had complained to the Wage and Hour Division is an adverse action, regardless of what had happened before. But I think that the district court's finding was that they were fired within a week of the complaint because they complained to the Wage and Hour Division.
May I ask, Judge Timkovich earlier was asking some counsel about, okay, we're writing the opinion, maybe it was Judge Lucero. If we're writing the opinion here, where do we state your authority of the DOL to bring an action for damages for retaliation? I don't see, it's kind of offhanded, implied in one provision, but if you look at the statutory provisions giving the DOL authority, I don't see any that specifically says you can sue for damages. So how do we write an opinion saying the DOL is proceeding under this statute?
Your Honor, Section 217 gives the Secretary authority to request injunctive relief from a district court, and that authority, of course, is quite broad.
It's under 217.
217.
That's for injunctive relief.
Yes.
Okay, but this is a claim for damages. This is not an equitable action. This is a legal claim for damages, and I don't see that under 217.
Well, the Secretary also has authority under 216. I believe it's in B, or it might be in C. I apologize, Your Honor.
B says that the right of action by a private person terminates upon the Secretary of Labor doing something, which is a strange way to confer authority on the Department of Labor. And that's why I was curious about where is there, and I couldn't find any specific authority out there, any case law saying that DOL has authority to bring a claim for damages for retaliation. I couldn't see where that had been specifically addressed by a court.
Your Honor, I don't have authority to cite for you, and I will agree that the remedies provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act are not a perfect model of clarity, but it's, I think, well understood by courts that the Secretary has broad authority to bring enforcement actions under the Act, and that any remedies
They definitely have authority to bring enforcement actions. And they can bring it for not paying overtime. That's clear. They have authority there. And they have authority for injunctive relief when there's retaliation, presumably. I just don't see any provision that gives authority to bring a claim for damages for retaliation, and I didn't find any clear understanding by the courts that authority exists. The issue is ignored, as it was in all the briefing in this case. But sometimes we have to write an opinion, and you start out saying DOL is proceeding under this authority, and I don't see what we can say.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court's equitable authority to issue wide varieties of kinds of relief under its equitable powers
includes a claim for damages for retaliation.
Well, it's a remedy for a violation of the statute. I apologize because this issue
I don't
issue
think that
wasn't
would be considered an
briefed.
Okay.
I am not fully prepared
I'm curious
to answer your
about
question.
That, and I won't take any longer because it wasn't argued, but it's a fundamental issue.
Your Honors, we're also asking the court to resolve the legal issues raised by this case. First, to conclude that the anti-retaliation provision of the FLSA by prohibiting any person from discriminating against an employee applies to a broader set of actors than just covered employers, but also to hold that foreclosure is a covered employer for purposes of the minimum wage and overtime provisions of the Act. There is an ongoing overtime investigation of foreclosure, and foreclosure has repeatedly argued at summary judgment in a motion for reconsideration and then again at trial that it's not a covered employer, which prompted the court to ask the secretary to present evidence on this issue, and foreclosure should be precluded from continuing to argue this matter and from requiring the secretary and potentially another district court from expending more resources resolving the question. They're quite clearly a covered employer. It's been amply proved, and the district court's findings were well supported by the record. If Your Honors have no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Session of time. The case is submitted, and counsel are excused. Thank you. Hold on. Go ahead and frame your question.
Yes. You said you could provide supplemental authority. I'd be interested in some supplemental briefing on DOL's authority to bring a claim for the relief they're seeking here.
Certainly.
And
is that clear on the damages question?
Yes. Yes.
And counsel, we'll give you 14 days. If you need more, let us know. Okay. All right. Counsel are excused a second time.
Thank you.
Now it counts.